Okay, so thanks for all of you for coming. So I want to just mention that all this work I'm going to talk about today, all the experimental work that will be the focus of my talk, is done with another postdoc in the lab I'm in, Arjun Raj. So it's I want to give him credit up front. So what I'd like to do first is just set the background, set the context in which I want to put the actual meat of my talk. And the reason for that is that, as you'll see, the talk is somewhat more of a developmental biology talk than classical evolutionary biology. But it's really about genotype-phenotype map. And so I want to set the stage with some concepts which probably have already come up during these 3 months, and then fit the data I'll be talking about into that context. So in 1963, Ernst Mayr claimed that really mutation or processes that generate variation really are not creative. They only just supply the variation. It's really up to selection to really do things with it and be the creative force of evolution. It was in 63. But even at that time, people didn't quite agree. So one person was Conrad Waddington, who's experienced somewhat of a revival in the last 10, 15 years. And he made the point that changes in the phenotype are not random. Mutation, the underlying process, the underlying mutation to the genome may be random, but the thing is that those effects are filtered through some development. They're filtered through some processes that actually generate your variation. And these are not random. Because there's all these interactions with many genes. And the key thing is that this developmental process only allows certain sorts of variation to actually appear, to be selected, selected in the first place. And so if we can understand what variation is allowed and what variation just will never appear, then we can understand how development can affect evolution. So, for example, you're just not going to get a Pegasus, or you're not going to get a pterodactyl limb on a Drosophila. Sorry to say for the Drosophilus. Okay, so I know that this picture has been shown earlier in the session. This is Waddington's famous epigenetic landscape, where he's talking about how development is channeled to go down certain paths, and underneath this are all these interactions of all these genes. This was a very metaphorical, allegorical picture in 1956. But 16 years before, he had a more concrete view of this epigenetic landscape that's pictured here. And the idea here is that we have, this is again on a fly head, and you have alternative paths to development. So you can go down normal development and produce a fly with a normal arista, which is the sensory organ. And there may be different alleles that sort of give you different sorts of arista, a normal arista, a thread arista, or a short arista. Or if you have a mutation in this gene Spinalis aristopedia, then you in fact get, instead of this nice feathery arista, you actually get a tarsus on your head instead. And again, there are some different alleles that sort of manage the fine structure of this tarsus. But the key thing is that you have this path here where it channels you into either normal development or a tarsus. But it's not that you get a wing on your head or something else. You always get this, the mutation causes this, you go down this particular path. So development channels you in a particular way. Now, if we do a thought experiment and we say, let's say what we want to do is we want to know just what's the potential for this system to vary, and to vary under some particular process. So let's say, what's the potential for this system to vary under mutation? So you take a fly, and you take a population of identical flies, and you just subject them to lots and lots of mutation. And then you just look at their heads, and you see, well, what do I get? Do I get an arista? Do I get a fat arista? Do I get a thread arista? Do I get tarsus? What do I get? And you might get some distribution of phenotypes that look something like this. Of course, most times, the mutation is not going to hit anything to do with this pathway. So you're going to have normal arista. But occasionally you'll hit these other ones, something like that. And so what you've done, if you measure all these phenotypes across this mutated population, you get a distribution of phenotypic effects, essentially the phenotypic effect of mutation. So you get a picture of what the variability of the system is. Now we can think about what's actually generating that variability and how is the genetic system set up to give you a particular distribution of phenotypes. So one thing one might do is duplicate spineless erysipedia and then repeat the experiment. And you can see that because we've changed the underlying genetic system, what we've changed is not the variation per se, because if you don't do anything to these flies, with two copies of spineless erysipedia with respect to this arista, they're going to all look normal. It's not going to really affect them. But we've changed the variability of the system. You've changed the capacity to vary under mutation. Because now when you mutate these, the chance of you mutating both of these genes to something non-functional is going to be pretty much nil. So you've basically eliminated this whole branch of your pathway. In fact, you've made the system much more robust to mutations with respect to going down this pathway. So this is just an example of this distinction between variation and variability. And variation is what I think much of population genetics is about, actually studying the distribution of differences among individuals in a population, trying to understand the forces that generate that particular distribution of variation. And variability is a component of it, but it's a component, especially when you're thinking about phenotypes, about distributions of phenotypes, then you need to think about what is the potential for this underlying developmental system to actually vary? What sort of distributions of phenotypes are actually produced? Now, there's a couple different concepts that, or sort of organizing concepts that fall under this rubric of variability. I'm going to just hit on, I think, the three key ones. One is integration or modularity, which essentially talks about if you have different phenotypic features, different traits, how do they covary? And how is that shaped by either how they develop? Maybe they develop from a common precursor or a common group of cells, or maybe they share certain genes, or maybe there's some functional, you might imagine that the common variation is sort of imposed by, they don't share mechanistically anything, but they're responding to similar environmental cues, and there's just no variation because there's been selection for particular functional relationships between these body parts. So a classic example of modularity is butterfly eye spots, where you can, to some extent, take out particular eye spots at will. In this case, a bicyclist butterfly. Another organizing concept is canalization. And this is essentially the idea that that if something is canalized, then essentially you produce the same phenotype across a wide range of environmental or genetic backgrounds. So there's basically a restriction in variation, an insensitivity, a buffering to outside forces. And the third one, which is what my talk's going to be about mainly today, which is about stability or instability. And this is, in some respects, the converse of canalization. The question is, why is there if you have exactly the same genotypic and exactly the same environmental conditions, how variable are you anyway? Like, how robust is development, even if you try to hold everything else constant? And this is a particularly gruesome example of that. But again, this is a single individual and same genetics, clearly, presumably same environmental conditions. But in fact, you get different phenotypes on the two hands. So for some reason, even though our hand development is obviously very stable, this individual, there's been something to disturb the underlying variability. And so you get this different display of hand phenotype. So I'll be talking mainly about this stability, this third organizing concept of variability. And I'll be asking the questions of where are the boundaries of normal development? So when you have normal development, pretty much we all share features and we obviously vary, but we vary within bounds. Where are the boundaries of that, and what happens when you transgress those boundaries? And given that there's all this variation out there, there's genetic variation, there's environmental variation, there's just stochastic variation, How does an organism actually stay within those boundaries? How is the developmental system set up so that you develop normally most of the time? So my model system will be gene expression. And in particular, let me looking at stochasticity of gene expression and its consequences for development. So this is a field that's really sort of taken off in the last, probably the last 5 years. This is a picture of genotypically identical E. coli. They're expressing green fluorescent protein under the control of the same promoter, you know, pretty much the same environmental conditions. And you can see there's actually a wide variation in expression of this particular protein. You know, some cells are actually quite dark, some are quite light. This all started from a single cell. So most of this work, most of this stochastic gene expression work has been done in microorganisms and bacteria and yeast in particular. Here's some examples. This is yeast. This is what they've done here is they basically the same promoter is a diploid yeast one allele has essentially one promoter driving red fluorescent protein. The homologous allele has one protein driving green fluorescent protein. And you can see that, in fact, there's variation between these two alleles. So some cells are red, which means one allele is expressing. Some cells are green, that means the other allele is expressing. Some cells are yellow, meaning both alleles are expressing. So again, it doesn't get any more controlled environmental conditions than this. This is the same two alleles in the same cell, and you can see there's a sort of intrinsic variation in gene expression here. Here's another example with Chinese hamster ovary cells. Again, this is looking at RNA expression, and again you see that one cell is really blazingly bright and the other cell is not doing anything. I'll leave the other one for a second. People have also looked at this in development, and stochastic effects in development have been known for some time, but it's been hard to really get at the mechanistic basis. But of course, one classic example is the white allele in Drosophila. You see variegated patterns in Drosophila eye, where you have white and red blotches, and this is known for a long time. There are some genes, especially the spineless erysipelagia, which I mentioned before, which are expressed in the eye. And essentially, random expression of this gene affects what color that particular facet is going to be sensitive to, what wavelength of light. Another classic example is butterfly wing patterns. So here you have some sort of signal gradient, and the cells at some distance from the gradient respond to that gradient and produce pigment or don't produce pigment. And you can see that even the same distance from the gradient, there is some variation in whether they will produce pigment or not. This is a final example, which these little dots are actually DPP expression. That's a gene that's expressed in the Drosophila wing, and it's expressed right on the sort of a boundary between engrailed expression. Sort of right in the edge of a grailed expression, you can see this is actually RNA, molecules of RNA, and you can see there's quite a bit of variation along this line.
What's the scale of this picture?
This picture?
Yeah.
This is about...
And roughly, what's the size of a cell?
What's the size of a cell? A cell is about this. Not too big.
So we're looking at the DPP containing vesicles there?
Sorry?
We're looking at DPP containing vesicles there?
I think that this is actually just RNA in the cell. I don't know the resolution to see exactly what it's in. Okay. So if we think about development, then one way to picture it is that in development you need gene expression at a particular time. Okay, so you have expression going up, and it may be that what happens is that if you have a gene over development, it needs to be expressed by a certain time. And it doesn't really matter how much it's expressed, just as long as it gets expressed enough at a particular time. So you have expression going up, in some critical window, it needs to reach the threshold level of expression, and then and then it goes back down after it's no longer needed. And it may be that alternative self fates happen because you either reach this critical threshold or you don't. So in the case of the spineless Aristopedia, the mutation of this gene that I showed earlier with the Drosophila with the Arista and the tarsus on a head, it may be that if you get enough spineless Aristopedia, then you develop your Arista on your head. If you don't, then you fall into this other category and you go down a different developmental path and develop tarsi on your head. But I think the key thing is that levels of gene expression are dynamic traits, they're temporal traits, and the meaning of variation gene expression really depends on whether there are thresholds or not. So it depends on how the system is set up. So my model system is Cenobrachydes elegans, the C. elegans, a nematode worm. Nice thing about it is that it's clear, so you can actually see inside it. Another nice thing about it is that the fate map is completely known. So there's 959 cells in a hermaphrodite C. elegans, and all C. elegans are exactly the same with respect to the fate of those 959 cells. So you know exactly what the cell divisions are, and you know exactly what each cell is going to become. And of course, stop me at any time.
There's no variation in that?
There's some variation in cell divisions, in timing of divisions. There's, I think, two cell fate variations. So one, a cell either divides and then fuses with its neighbor, or fuses and then divides. And another one, there's a cell that is sort of the a signaling cell for vulval development, and it can be one of two cells, and it seems to be 50-50 choice. So far as I know, that's the only difference, the only potential difference in C. elegans. Although I was just reading that actually there's variation in timing of cell division and sort of orientation of cell divisions. But as far as cell fate,
In terms of like number of cells, there's no, they all have exactly 953.
So far as I've read, now males. Hold on. What?
These must be within the lab lines that you look at.
They are within lab lines, although I haven't seen any. So people have collected different lines from around the world, and I haven't seen reports. I could be wrong, but I haven't seen reports that this actually differs in these other ones. Now, males are actually a little more variable. They have different tails, and I think there's some more variation in the tails. So it's like 1,081 cells versus, or 1,061 cells or something there.
And no one's done a screen for, EMS or radiation or something to see if you could get.
Oh yes, there have been screens, definitely.
They
so
just pop up nothing for variation in number of cells.
Well, so under EMS, if you mutagenize them, then you can mess with the cell number.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have people actually done fate mapping in different genotypes, like natural isolates?
Yeah. People have been doing redoing so. The initial fate mapping was done in 83, and basically by a bunch of people who spent 5 years, just tracking cells through the microscope, and they got a Nobel Prize, and it was well-deserved, because that's an excruciatingly boring work. Now what you can do is you can actually, you can insert GFP, you basically make transgenic worms with GFP histone, so histone tag GFP. So histone is a gene that's basically expressed in the chromosome, so in the nucleus. And then, so your nuclei light up. And you can do microscopy, basically, over time, so take slices of the organism over time and track it more automatedly, more automatically. And I know that people have been doing this, so they've redone it for the main strain. I think they've redone it, but I'm not entirely sure.
I feel like most C. elegans developmental biologists are working with N2 or Bristol and not yeah.
Yeah. So that's. I know that I don't actually know, but that's actually something I've done. Yeah. I don't actually know if they've done it, but I know they're also moving on to other species, and it seems to be again, a close related species. Again, is exact. From what I understand,
Briggsia is exactly the same.
From what I understand, Briggsia is exactly the same. Yeah, so, but again, I don't know exactly how much detail that is, but it's there to do it.
And one last, and for those EMS irradiated C. elegans that I guess were used to do some of the cell mapping or whatever, are those also like say 649 exactly?
No, you can get lots of. So if you mutate them, you can get variation in cell number. And actually, the mutations I'll be talking about a little bit later, you actually do get variation in cell number.
But then is it consistent? Does it go to a particular?
That's a good question. I don't know that. That's an important question. At least for the mutations that I'll be talking about, it doesn't. Like there is some variation there. It doesn't go to a specific number. What would be very interesting, though, you're right, is if you had mutations that change the number, and change it substantially, not just one cell division, but it was always that number. So C. elegans was thought to be a model of what's called mosaic development. So mosaic development in your ideal case is basically every cell or every cell lineage develops independently. It does its own thing, and there's really no communication between different cells. It was thought that C. elegans developed a lot like that. It's not really quite, it might be as close as an example as we have in animals, but it's not entirely true. So there is some communication between cells. If you had a time in development where basically this particular cell lineage was going to develop autonomously, then, if you could catch that early enough and you got the mutation, you basically knocked out all those cells, it would always be the same number of cells. And to some extent, the mutation, the system I'm going to be talking about, gut development, is like as close as you will get to that. I don't know specifically. Okay, so C. elegans, it's very small, nice worm. Okay, and specifically I'll be talking about C. elegans embryogenesis. So here's a picture of Centrorhabditis embryogenesis. This is actually not C. elegans, but it was a nice picture I could find. This is actually C. briggsi, but again, they look exactly the same. So you can see you start with a cell, divides into two, divides into four, and I'll be focusing on essentially the offspring of this cell. That divides into two, and then this cell here will become, all its precursors become gut, and the gut is only derived, the intestine, the gut, and the gut is only derived from these cells. So it splits into two, and then it also is the first group of cells that gastrulate. So embryos go through this process where essentially there is just a ball of cells. Most embryos in the animal kingdom are a ball of cells, and then they start movements. And so gastrulation is where they start to fill in the interior of this ball. So these EA and EP, these gut precursor cells, are the first ones to start moving into the center of the embryo. And then they divide in there and basically form the gut. What's sort of interesting is you can actually use a laser and knock out all the cells except for these two and its neighbors, and it will still move toward the center. So again, I was talking about this highly mosaic, independent development. You can knock out a whole bunch of other cells, and these things still make the movements they're supposed to make. So it's pretty autonomous, although it's known that there are some interactions, some induction interactions. But once they get to this point where you have two cells that are the precursor just before they're about to gastrulate, pretty independent, pretty on its own. So they move into the embryo and they divide in a stereotypical pattern and form guts. Nice thing about this system, endoderm or gut, same thing. The nice thing about this system, sorry, there are lots of terms, I didn't keep it. Nice thing about this system is that the gene network controlling it is pretty well worked out, pretty decently worked out. And it's actually very short. So what happens is you have this maternally deposited gene, SCN1. And so in C. elegans, there's actually the mother will express RNA. She'll make transcripts. And when I understand, cells sort of form, and they form in the area where all this RNA is around. They encapsulate the RNA. So that cells embryos are born, or C. elegans is born, already containing RNA. Before they have to make any. This is pretty common. Of course, it happens in Drosophila as well. But this is a pretty important thing to have this, because it starts off, in addition to other cascades, it starts off this gut-making cascade. So it activates these two genes. These are essentially identical. They're paralogs. They're essentially identical. MEN1 and 2. It activates this gene, N3. These feed in to activate this one and this one. Now, there's essentially this specification cascade. So they specify that you will become a gut. And then once you specify you will become a gut, you actually have to make the gut itself. That's what ALT2 does. Once you express this gene, it has a positive feedback loop, so it auto-regulates itself. And then it activates some 4,000 other genes to actually build the gut. So the key thing for gut development is to get to here. Once you got this thing expressed, then you're golden. You're going to make a gut. Now, N3 and N1 are also paralogs, but a little bit more distantly related. I won't talk about WEE1 in this talk. So here's the cascade. So basically, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 genes. And in this talk, so essentially 5 genes in this cascade to get to gut.
Two arrows coming in, that's an and relationship.
It's an and, yeah. Both,
right? Yes, exactly. Well, not necessarily. What I mean there is that it's known that both of these things will regulate. It could be an or. Both of these things can regulate this. It's not necessarily an AND gate. It could be an OR gate or something more in between. Okay, so let me just show you a picture of this of expression of this last gene. Actually, what I want to do first, I'm just going to draw up here this cascade. I'll refer to this throughout my talk, so it's really good to have it. So what I'll be showing here is this gene, so this terminal differentiation gene, this expression of this gene. Oops. Okay, so let me show you what you're looking. Let me tell you what you're looking at. The blue are nuclei, so it just stains, essentially staining the DNA in the nuclei. The red dots are actually individual RNA molecules. In the embryo. Wait one more time. So this, and what this is essentially a stack through the embryo. It's just a Z-stack. So these embryos are fixed. They're not alive anymore. And this is probably about maybe 50 cell stage or something like that, maybe a little later. And you know, what you can see is that there's. Find the next picture a little better. You can see that there's some fuzzy. You know, fuzzy pink or red, that's just background noise. But the bright spots are individual molecules of RNA. So this is expression of L2, this terminal differentiation gene. You can see it's sort of in the middle of the embryo where you would expect, because these cells, remember, move into the center of the embryo and make a gut there. And one nice thing about this is that unlike, say, using microarrays or RT-PCR or something like that, we have absolute numbers of expression here, so we're actually counting individual molecules of RNA, which is quite nice. So the way that we do that is just a variant of in situ hybridization, where we have our RNA molecule, and we have only 20 mers, so these short oligos that are fluorescently labeled at the end that are complementary to this. And by tiling enough of these along the transcript, we get a bright enough signal. So the idea is if we just had one of these on the transcript, then we wouldn't see it. We wouldn't be able to see the signal from one fluorophore. But the fact that there are 48 of them there, or we can do it down to about 25, the fact that there are a large number of them there, that they're all attached to this transcript, so they're concentrated in a small area, really makes you able to see the signal. The other nice thing is that you know, these are short oligos, and they may bind nonspecifically. But again, if you just have one or two, or actually less than 20, binding nonspecifically somewhere, the signal's not big enough to see. So you get the sort of diffuse background, but not really spots. So by virtue of you having to have enough of them, you get not only, you get specificity, and you also get this nice spot. So what we can do then is go and count these spots, and that gives us absolute levels of expression. So that's the technology I'll be using to get the data that I'll be talking about later in the talk.
So you just design that for whatever RNA.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the other really nice thing about this, which I'm planning to exploit, which is that these are native RNAs, so there's no transgenics here. This is all native. So you can go and do, whatever, as long as you can see it on the microscope. There's some, if the microscopy will allow it, you can do this on non-model organisms.
And if you use different pores, you can do like alternative splicing or something like that, right?
Yeah, so again, the key thing though is that you need enough sequence length. So I'm working on a project now where alternative splicing is actually a problem. And so alternative splicing is important to the system. Maybe not for the exact question I'm asking. The problem is that the unique sequences is only about 500 base pairs. So there's just almost, there's not quite enough to really be able to see a spot well. Signal's not quite bright enough. But if you have enough sequence that are different between your two isoforms, yeah, no problem.
And these oligos bind independently, so you can calculate fluctuations due to binding and unbinding of these things.
Sorry, you can say that again? I didn't hear.
So what is the binding kinetics? So is there any cooperativity in binding of these things, or are they uncooperative so that you can estimate, for example, the probability of failure to get all 20?
Right. So I don't know that. I would assume that they're not cooperative. It's not clear to me why they would be cooperative, but I just don't know. I haven't exploded.
Binding to non-overlapping.
Yeah, they're binding to non-overlapping things. Now.
Well, but for example, if there is some sort of secondary structure there.
No, that's certainly true. I don't know that answer. Now, sort of related. So, one thing is that, as I said, we can see a spot with about 25, so we have overkill here. But maybe another part of your question is that how do you know you're actually getting, how do you know what error there is in your counting? So, it's difficult to answer that question because we don't have many technologies to actually measure absolute expression. I'll tell you one thing I did, which was I'm not going to be talking about today, but I have a very, very long transcript. I essentially made 70-something oligos to bind to this, and I labeled half in one color and half in another color. And of course, they don't overlap. And then I looked to see what the overlap is between these two colors, and it's really, really good. So from that, I conclude that, A, we're pretty much getting, there's very, very low error. We're probably picking up most of what's there. But I think the question still remains and should remain, which is, I don't exactly know what the measurement error is. Yeah. Okay, so given the microscopy setup we have to work with, we can essentially look at three colors at once, three different fluorophores at once, plus DAPI. So here's a plot of a field of embryos with different, you can see they're slightly different stages. Again, because C. elegans has the same pattern of cell divisions, this has one very nice advantage for developmental biology, which is pretty rare in organisms, which is that if I see a 26-cell embryo here and 26-cell embryo there, they're pretty much the same. You know, as close to the same as you can get, as opposed to some other things where it's really hard to know if they're really at the exact same stage. Now there is some variation there, but it's about as close as you can get. So because we can stain the nuclei, we can actually count how many nuclei are in an embryo, and so we can actually stage these embryos. So we can do is image, you know, embryos, image one gene, so in this case the N3 gene, image another gene in another color, and image one other color. Now another nice thing about this particular system is that this gene, this MED12, these are paralogs, and they're basically identical, so we can't actually distinguish them with this in situ hybridization technique. But these genes and this one don't express at the same time at all. There's no overlap. And so we can stain them with the same color. Yeah.
I was just wondering if you can, you don't have a cell boundary marker,
yeah.
So you can't say how many RNAs are in each individual,
yeah,
cell, right? You do say I give you a ballpark, but they don't really show you
what. Right, exactly. It would be really nice to actually get cell-specific expression, obviously. And that hasn't worked so far. I just haven't been able to get it to work reliably, these cell boundary markers, but that's obviously a crucial piece that unfortunately is missing. There are embryos there are strains where they've integrated a GFP marker, for instance, to mark the cell boundaries, and for very early embryos it works okay, although not all the time. For these late stage ones, we just haven't found a way to do it yet. So we can do, you know, as an approximation, which is going to be off. We can basically say, you know, take an RNA and say which nucleus is it closest to. Draw some sort of Voronoi shell around a nucleus. But yeah, we can't do that quite yet.
Just to confirm, these are fixed tissues.
These are fixed, yes. Okay, so as I was saying, we can do three colors at once. And because these two don't express at the same time, we can stain them with the same color. So we can essentially look at, after skin one, all the genes in this pathway and the same embryos. So here's just a picture of what it looks like. Skip that. Okay, so here's what the data looks like. So we have, this is a plot of MED expression, so this gene up here. And the top panel is by number of nuclei. Okay. The bottom panel is by minutes since fertilization. Now, this is somewhat of an approximation based on some of these lineaging experiments. So this is not, we didn't actually measure minutes. We used their data to translate our nucleus number into minutes. But in some ways, it looks a little nicer, so I'll split them. Okay, so you can see that MED expression goes up and down, early on. Here's a picture of N3 expression. A little bit later, again, it goes up. This is when gastrulation happens, right here. So it basically peaks just before gastrulation. It basically ends expression just before gastrulation. This third gene, which N1, which actually comes on and lasts a lot longer. And finally, this L2 gene, which is in this master differentiation gene, is activated and then essentially stays on throughout the organism's life, because it really coordinates gut development and also functioning. So, you know, by measuring expression of these different embryos, we can get a picture of what pathway expression looks like. So you have these waves of expression. We have one activating the other, activating the other. So you can get a picture of what the time course of expression looks like in normal embryos. And the other thing we can get, as I'll show a little bit later, is we can get a sense of, for embryos at the same stage, how much variation is there.
Okay. And what's the experimental variation from, can you do technical replicates?
No. I mean, you can do technical replicates for some things. You can't assay the same embryo again.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you can't assay the, really, but you could do you can assay some things like batch effect and stuff like that, and you really don't see much of an effect of that.
So there's no way. I mean, do it, wash it off, do it again, or something like that. You know, where
with one of your long genes, what if you alternated the color of fluorescent molecule that you attached to every other probe or something like that? So you have two independent signals.
Yeah. So I've done that, and the signal is really, really, really highly correlated. They basically have the same thing. But so I can do that sort of technical replicate, but I can't for some aspects of the procedure. I don't have any way to assess.
You think you're basically getting every transcript that's there, so that your estimate is.
I think the estimate is really good. I can't say if I'm getting the estimate. I can't say if I'm getting every transcript, but I think it's pretty close.
So the variation that we're seeing here is
among different
individuals.
Among different individuals, yes.
But C. elegans are hermaphrodites, right? So presumably they're very similar genetically.
These should be genetically identical, or you know, genetically identical up to random mutation within one generation. Well, random mutation within a few generations.
These aren't SIBs or something like that.
I mean, yeah. So within a few generations. These are basically, you know, we start with the small plate, expand it out, and then collect the embryos. So there, you know, there's going to be some accumulation of mutations during that time, but you know, the chance of them hitting one of the chance, because it's a very early pathway, I think the chance of it hitting this and really affecting things is pretty low. But yeah, you can't rule that out. Yeah.
Like just based on these dynamics, it doesn't really seem that like. ELT2 is controlled by M3, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'll get to that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you look, okay, there's two. I do want to say.
The AND gate, let's say, at least doesn't seem to be.
Yeah. Although here's one thing to remember: that this is not protein. This is just RNA.
Right.
So you know you have RNA expression.
Yes, sure.
It'd be nice to be able to look at protein molecules too, but so far as I know, you can't.
Yeah.
yeah. So these are producing protein, and then you know that'll stick around. Yeah. Okay, any other questions?
Basically, you have on the order of 1 minute with developmental time resolution. I mean, the number of nuclei on the minute since fertilization.
Well.
Same scales, more or less. I mean, you can count the number of nuclei.
Well, okay, yeah.
You're adding a nucleus.
Yeah, so it's not quite like that because, so I said this is somewhat of an approximation. The reason why it's not quite like that is because you have waves of division. So, you know, you're jumping from 26 to some higher number, but you stay at one stage for a while. And what I'm doing here is I'm to get these minutes since fertilization. I'm saying, well, look, it's a 26 stage from, you know, like 50 through 60 minutes. So I'm just picking at random one of those. So that's why this is really just an approximation. But what this is nice for though is to just look at the off and on dynamics and see the smoothness of that. So it's not entirely.
So a little, maybe like 4 or 5 or 6 minutes or something.
Something like it varies depending on this and the particular.
Where you are.
Yeah, depending on whether you're coming in a coordinated wave or whether there's actually more variation. So once you start, and you can see that actually from the nuclei counts because you can see that there are these sort of these batches,
yeah.
Right? There are gaps, batches and gaps. So the other thing I should say is that as far as nuclei, error in nuclei counting. So we essentially count the nuclei basically by hand. So I think that there is up to maybe a hand, computer-assisted hand. But basically, I think up to here, certainly up through here, I don't think there's any error. Or maybe you know one nucleus per several embryos. This is pretty spot on. You might start to get a little more error, and here there might be maybe 5 nucleus error. But I think that for most of the time, most of these 0 through 200 nuclei, I think the nucleus count error is actually very, very low. You had a question? Okay. Okay, so we have this trajectory, we have this expression, trajectory of expression, and it tells us something like, it tells us these waves of waves of expression. We can look at the on and off dynamics, but it doesn't give us that much insight into the actual workings of the system. And so we took a page out of Harvey's book, and essentially what we wanted to do was to derange the system in some way. Of course, Harvey was an early geneticist. Harvey was actually a physiologist. That was supposed to be a joke. So the first, he showed that blood circulated throughout the body. There was no genetics back then. But we still deranged the system in some way. Okay, so what I want to look at is partial penetrance. So I showed this picture before where this individual has some mutation. I don't remember which one it is. But what happens is that this mutation is what's called partially penetrant. So if a mutation were fully penetrant, then when you have the mutation, you have the phenotype. But most mutations are not like that. And in fact, in medical literature, it's very common for there to be partial penetrance. Of course, in medicine, oftentimes what they're talking about is you have, you know, say a particular allele of BRCA1, and you know, it's somewhat penetrant, but of course there's genetic factors, there's environmental factors. And so in medical literature, often you have an allele, it's partially penetrant, but there could be a whole host of reasons. In this individual, of course, the genetics and the environment are exactly the same. And the C. elegans, we can pretty much control the genetics and the environment. So the only source of variation that's really left is random variation through the developmental process. And in this case, what we're going to be looking at is random variation in gene expression and seeing whether that plays a role in partial penetrance. So the system you're talking about is if you mutate this allele, this SCN1, this maternal transcript, what happens is that some embryos develop gut cells, some embryos have guts, or at least some gut cells, and some embryos just have nothing. So SCN1, the mutation in SCN1 is partially penetrant for presence or for absence of gut cells. Okay, so we're going to take mutants in SCN1 and look at expression in this pathway and see if we can relate partial penetrance to the dynamics of this pathway. And this was work done in 92 where they looked at the various alleles of this SCN1 gene. In this talk, I'll be talking about 129 and 135, so those will appear in my titles. And they see that, first of all, it's temperature sensitive. I'm not going to be talking about the temperature sensitivity today. But if you look at 25C, you can see that the ZU129, about 54% of the embryos actually have intestinal cells. Now, I should say that all of these embryos are you know, pretty much almost fully penetrant for loss of pharynx. So these embryos die. They eventually die, but before they die, they do develop gut cells. And they die well after the point where L2 should be expressed. So we can tell if the pathway has actually gone to completion or not in these embryos. But you can see that between 129 and 135, there's actually a pretty big difference in penetrance. So 135 is a much more severe allele. Why it's a more severe allele, we don't actually know. And the reason, and it's sort of puzzling because this 135 mutation is actually toward the end of the protein. So the 129 mutation is actually sort of in the middle of the protein. So it's not entirely clear why the one that's mutated, and they're both premature stop codons. So it's not entirely clear why if you get a stop codon in the middle of your protein, you're somehow more functional than if you get a stop codon until the end of the protein. That still remains to be worked out. One idea might be that you often have, stop codons don't often mean that they're actually stop codons. And when people are designing stop codon in a system, like when they want to put one in, artificially design it, they haven't put two in a row. Because you often get the case that there's read-through, that the transcriptional machine, the translational machine will just read through the stop codon and continue on. So it could be that, in fact, and whether or not you read through depends on which stop codon you are and also the context around it. So it could be that this one, the reason, even though it's in the middle of a protein, is just sort of a less functional stop codon. But we don't know that. We don't know why. Okay, so here's a picture, again, of L2 expression, similar to what I showed you before. And you can see that these are identical embryos. And this is just noise here, this background. You can see that one of them has, you know, is blazing with L2 expression. The other ones just don't have anything. So what this means is that this mutation is not only partially penetrant for gut development, but it's also partially penetrant for L2 expression, which is good because the data I'll be talking about is not actually gut cell development, but it's really L2 expression, which should be correlated with gut cell development. And we're it's not entirely easy to acid the two at the same time, and we're still working on that. Do you want to? Sorry.
Can I explain? What was the other one, the third one? You said it was noise?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. Oh, so this diffuse purple stuff here is just sort of background expression. The actual transcripts are these bright dots.
I understand, but the background is not in not uniform throughout the...
Yeah, so I've contrasted this image a bit in the image processing. So it sort of depends on how I made the image. I don't actually know why that is. Yeah.
So am I interpreting right that the stochasticity is on off between individual cells, not variability in total expression across cells? You want me to restate that?
Yeah.
So just from that image, it looks like this gene is either on or off in individual cells. Right, that's one way to be variable in your expression.
Yeah.
The other is that you're producing different amounts of that transcript in each individual cell, but all of them still produce some.
Oh, sure, yeah, yeah.
So I guess I'm asking if my interpretation of this image, which is on-off between different cell types, is that the source of stochasticity is correct?
I think that's correct. It's somewhat hard to tell because, as you said before, we can't actually measure it in individual cells. Now, the other thing with respect to that is these are somewhat late-stage embryos. And so the thing is that they needed to get back much, much before this.
I'll actually take my question back because I was thinking of those as individual nuclei, not every other.
Okay. Should we take a break?
Whenever you feel it's
good. Yeah, why don't we take a break and then come back?
Okay.
It's a good time. Let me continue. Any other questions just before we dive in?
Yeah.
Okay. So what I want to do now is essentially present some of the data from the expression of this pathway in the mutant, compare it to the wild type, and see what we can learn that way. Okay. So again, here's wild type expression, just to so you can see it, and. So for the mutant data, I'm pretty much just going to be presenting things in terms of number of nuclei. Okay, so again, in the beginning of the talk, I put this up here. The idea being that it may happen in development that what you need is you need expression to reach above some threshold level during some critical window. After that critical window or before that critical window, it doesn't really matter. But if you're below it, then you go into one cell fate. If you're above it, you go into a different one. So what might be happening is that in wild type, you basically always get above this threshold. In this mutant, maybe sometimes you get above the threshold and you produce gut cells, or in our case, you produce L2 expression, and sometimes you don't. The other thing to keep in the back of the mind, in your mind, is that if development works this way, where there are these thresholds and there's variation up here, then one question becomes, how do we interpret variation in expression between species if we don't know what the thresholds are? That's just... Okay, so here's this is one of those alleles. This is the more penetrant allele, so the one that has fewer guts. This is again the expression, and you can see a couple things. First of all, the med genes are gone. There's no med expression. That's up here. L and 1 pretty much gone, although you do have some embryos that are expressing. End one, very variable. And L2, it's sort of hidden by the blue here, but mostly gone, but you do get some embryos with it. So let me put up both, hold on. Shoot. Okay, well, I don't have the plot. Here's the other mutant. This is the slightly less penetrant one, and then the wild type on the bottom. Okay, so you can see that, compared to wild type, N1 expression is, or N3 expression is pretty much gone, even though you have a couple embryos with a lot. Again, N1 is just very variable. This is fairly tight. This is really quite variable, and you never, in the wild type, have any green right here on the bottom. You never get embryos that don't have L2 expression, whereas here you actually have quite a few. Okay. So what? If we look at these two mutants, that we have, one is the 129 is a little bit less severe than the 135. Look at the expression. Again, you can see, and this is just L2, so this is just this final gene, which is basically our readout of the system. You can see that one thing is that there's more, there's sort of more, when you have blue expression, you basically have very little in this area down here, so when you have expression a little bit higher for one of the mutants, I think there's overall usually more purple dots up here. There's different numbers of embryos in here too, so it's a little misleading. But what we wanted to do was figure out if we can find some threshold level of expression of L2 that you need in order to get guts versus not get guts. So obviously if you have zero L2 transcripts, then nothing's happening. But maybe, if you have one, is that sufficient to start this positive feedback loop? Or do you need some more? So essentially, is there some number of transcripts where we can really assess the penetrance level? Okay, so if we take if we make the plot like this, so this is the fraction of embryos above your threshold, the fraction of dots above the threshold for the two different genotypes by the threshold number of RNA, you can see, and remember that this, the green one, is the more severe phenotype. Okay, so the green one should be the one with less L2 RNA. You can see that there's this area. Like I said, this is the fraction of embryos above this threshold, and this is just the difference between the two. And you can see that there's this sort of plateau here, okay, where you basically have the same difference, different percentage of embryos above and below this threshold. Again, what this is fraction of embryos above the threshold, 129 minus 135. Now again, 129 is the less severe allele, so more of those embryos should have L2 expression. So in this range, basically there's this gap where the fraction of the embryos, the difference between the severity of 129 and 135 doesn't change. So essentially in this band here, in this band there, there's the same relative proportions. So but the bottom line is that, if we pick some threshold here, we essentially, just at the beginning, this may be some threshold number of L2 RNA where you get this difference between the severity of 129 and 135. That's actually, I think, not that important. Let's move on. What we want to do is try to figure out what's causing this partial penetrance. Where's the stochasticity coming? In those plots I showed you of expression, we saw that MED was gone, N3 was pretty much gone, N1 was highly variable, and L2 was highly variable. So that really points to N1 being really something we should focus on. And one thing you might ask is, okay, what we did is we mutated this gene up here. Okay? What happens if we mutate some of the others? What happens to the system? So here's, if we knock out this N3 gene, let me say one thing about N3, about these knockouts. It turns out that if you knock out N1, you have a null allele in N1, and this is a true null, so it's actually a deletion of part of the N1 transcript, of part of the N1 gene. You actually, the embryos are fine. Not only fine, they live. They develop guts, and they're fertile, they can breed, and you can maintain a stock, a homozygous deletion for this indefinitely. Okay, so those embryos are fine. If you knock out N3, then 95% of the embryos are fine. About 5% die. So these two seem to be somewhat partially redundant. If you knock out them, if you knock them both out, then the embryo, then the worms are toast. Okay. So, Okay. So what we want to do is take a look and see what's happening in these embryos if you actually knock out these genes. So if you look at an N3 knockout, so you knock out this gene, the reason why you see N3 transcript is because we still have some probes that bind to the non-knocked out region, but the protein is really non-functional. But you can see that there's an expression level of N1 may be a little lower than in the wild type, but you still get basically the same pattern of expression of N1 and L2. So despite the fact there being none of this gene, you're still getting expression of this and expression of that. So suggesting that there must be some other way to activate N1 other than N3. And remember, in these embryos, you also have functional SCN1. So there may be another link here as well. Or potentially here. Okay, so this is what an N3 knockout. And again, most of these embryos are actually perfectly fine. There may be a few that don't have enough L2 to actually make gut cells.
So actually, there seems to be a delay between the two expressions in the knockout. So do you see some retardation in the gut development?
Yes, no, so that's a very good point. So yeah, thank you for pointing that out. So yeah, so he's saying that look, in the wild type you start to get L2 expression around 50 cells. Here you start to get it much later. I don't know the answer to the second part of your question, what development looks like what later development looks like. I don't know the answer to your question. I should.
If you knock out N1 instead of N3,
yeah,
then on the wild type pattern, then you would get a gap between expression of N3 and then of L2, right?
Say one more time.
So if you knock out N1,
right,
and if you look at the wild type pattern, then yeah. Then if you remove N1 from this pattern,
yeah,
then you have this dip, and then there's this kind of gap between 20 and 40, right?
Right.
But you say if you knock out N1, it's still functional and most of them
yes.
still survive.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
why is it? Remember, this is RNA. So there are proteins. So this is making proteins, and the N3 proteins are presumably still around.
Okay.
They're not being degraded that quickly. Yeah. It's unfortunate we don't have the protein because that's what you'd really want as well. So there's this delay. This is a very interesting delay, suggesting. That come back to your question, what it hints at is that perhaps there is somewhat of an AND gate here. It's not a complete OR gate. It may be somewhat of some kind of hybrid where if you have both of these feeding into L2, then you can just start it right up. If you only have one of them, then perhaps it's just not as strong to really get the expression going as quickly.
And actually, if you do temperature dependent experiments, maybe you could have more proteins and
yeah, so
over the threshold, and maybe that's the risky of the effect.
So if you look actually, if you let these embryos develop at 15 degrees C, so what that does is it basically slows development down by something like 2.5 times from respect to this. you see that in fact far more of the embryos have gut cells. Now, I don't have data. I'm not going to present data from that. We haven't done those experiments exhaustively. So because it slows development, it sort of shifts development so much, I think it's actually a little hard to know what's going on. It shifts. Temperature change should probably shift degradation rates. It shifts a lot. But I think you're right that that could play a role. It could shift timing, why not? Maybe lengthen your threshold, lengthen the amount of time. If it lengthens the amount of time you stay at a particular stage, then that critical window might get broader. And if you don't change the dynamics of expression proportionally, then you may have much more time to get. If you're not quite as slow in getting expression up, you might be able to get it up there. So I think that's a good, very good point. Oops. Okay. So you were asking about N1 knockouts. So if you knock out N1, again, this is we can label some of the transcript, but this is not making functional protein. But you see that also compared to wild type, you're getting nonsense mediated decay. Okay, so here, again, like you mentioned, you seem to be getting a little bit of the delay. So this we're knocking out N1. So you're getting a little bit of delay, but you get perfectly fine L2 expression. This is sort of interesting because in the SCN1 mutants, remember we had this highly variable N1 expression, and we got this highly variable L2 expression. Here, of course, we have completely functional N3, almost at wild type levels. So this really, I think, just feeds into the idea that this is somewhat of it's an OR gate, but there may be some AND. It's an OR gate for expression of L2, but for the timing, it may be there may be some AND logic there. So I think this is important, is that expression is not, there's all these components to the dynamics of expression, and the influence of particular genes coming in can influence different parts of it, and they can combine in different ways. Okay. Okay. So just to nail down what the relationship is, so this again is this this SCN1 mutant. So this mutant, the more penetrant one, and I just want to focus a little bit more into the relationship between variable expression in N1 and whether or not you get. L2 expression. So again, trying to zero more into, you have this partial penetrance, and how does stochasticity, how does randomness in expression play into that? So what we did was, first thing is we measured just gene expression noise. So question is, can we quantify what the difference is between N1 expression in the mutant and the wild type? I mean, you can obviously see it's just much more variable here. And less variable here. So if we look at, if one thing we could do is we can take, just make an expression trajectory by essentially fitting some curve to normal expression. You can see that the blue line is the standard deviation of number of transcripts around this curve. You can see it really doesn't change so much. The standard deviation doesn't change so much along the course of development. Oftentimes, it's in many other systems, it looks like noise or your standard deviation scales with the mean. And so so it's just your coefficient of variation. And you can see that the coefficient of variation here is very low. And you can see that by this plot. The standard deviation doesn't change even though expression level goes up. So there's very little noise. The upshot is that in the wild type, there's actually very little noise. If you look at the mean, coefficient of variation is standard deviation divided by mean.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so if you look at the mutant, though, it's obviously more variable, and you get a coefficient of variation instead of like 0.4 all the time, you get around slightly less than 1, so more variable. If you think about just distributions, Poisson, if things get expressed according to a Poisson process, you'd have a coefficient of variation around like 1. And oftentimes for random gene expression, when you're modeling it, you use sort of a Poisson, use a Poisson process.
But right here, there's no way to tell whether this is variation that has been fed in by the SKN1 protein levels into the system, or whether that has to generate along the way during the cascade.
In the cascade. Yeah, that's a good point. We don't actually know, well, yes, we don't know what the source of this, I take your point.
Do you have an antibody probe for SKN1 protein?
I'm working on that. I do, but I'm trying to get the Westerns to work, so I can't answer the question right now. What I can say is that, that's the best I can do. I don't know exactly what the source of variation is. There is variation. I don't know exactly where the source is. But remember that this is what we want to try to explain is variation in L2, sort of this bimodal type behavior in L2 expression. So I'm essentially screening off at this level and asking what does the variation look like here and how does that feed into here.
But what you could potentially tell is whether there is some cells that behave normal and some cells that could be abnormal, or whether it is all cells behave the same but at a lower level.
Yeah, so that's a good question. And I don't have that data right now. It's a little hard. I can't exactly stain cell boundaries. No, exactly. That's what I need to do. The other way to do it that I haven't done quite yet is to look at essentially density, or look see if in this glob of L2 expression if there's differences in density between, and if it's more patchy in the mutant than the wild type. I haven't done that yet. Yeah. Okay, so here's... So, bottom line is that, as you can see by eye, the mutant is more noisy. The more penetrant mutant is also pretty noisy with the coefficient of variation around 1. If you look at this N3 knockout, then you see it goes back and it looks much more wild type, much more like wild type. So even though you're knocking out N3, N1 expression is still not particularly variable. And remember, if you knock out this N3 gene, 95% of the embryos are perfectly fine. So they're not getting more variable N1 expression. Maybe the levels seem to be a little lower, but there's not more variable. Okay. So now if we focus more on this N1 L2 relationship, and this is the last the last set of data I'll present. And we look in the same embryos, how many L2 and how many N1 transcripts are there in the same embryos? Now, remember that these genes are expressing at slightly different times. So N1 expresses before L2. There's going to have been some degradation, but there should be some. Degradation is not going to be quick enough. It doesn't appear to be quick enough to destroy any correlation between the two. So this is wild type. It's color coded by number of nuclei. Okay, and you can see that there's a long time where there's no L2 transcripts, but then it sort of follows this trajectory. Okay. So once you hit about, 300, 400 transcripts of N1, then you start getting L2 expression. Okay. If we look at the N3 knockout, and this was the one with the delay, you get this pattern where it goes up. Although there are some, you can see that there are these darker colors interspersed here, and that's coming from this delay that you had mentioned. But again, here you hit the bulk of it is where you hit about 300 transcripts, and then you start getting L2 expression. If you start looking at the mutants, then the correlation basically goes away. I should say it doesn't completely go away. Where you have L2 expression is up above this, say, 300 transcript of end one level. So you hit here, and then some of your embryos start to get L2 expression. And here it's a little more variable, maybe 200 transcripts, and then you start to get expression as well. I don't know exactly what's going on here. It could be that things are just degrading more quickly or whatnot. But effectively, what this suggests is that there does seem to be this some sort of threshold around about 200 N1 transcripts. That if you're variable, but if you can get above that in these mutants, if you can get above this 200, 300 transcript threshold at the right amount of time, in the right window of time, then you can get ELK2 expression, then you can produce some gut cells.
I'm sorry, at that time, how many cells are there that would be involved in this expression?
So in the wild?
Well, yeah, you're counting transcripts for the entire embryo. I'm just asking how many cells there are.
Yeah, so it's color coded by nuclei. So it depends on which particular embryo.
Right, so I'm just saying when you talk about 300 being necessary, they're divided amongst something like 100 cells.
Oh yeah. Hold on. Let me see just a second. I'll tell you in a second. So here it's about 50 cells. So that's going to be about 4 to 8, probably about eight gut cells at that time. Yeah. Roughly there,
okay.
Around that time. At about 50 nuclei, there's about 8 gut cells. There's ultimately about 20 gut cells, and they turn out to be polyploid at the end, which is sort of interesting. Not polynucleated. Sort of weird. But at this point, I think it's just 8 nuclei, just 8 gut cells. Okay, so... All right. Just to finish up, as I mentioned, because of this, there probably is this other shunt that goes down. And you can activate N1, so that even if you knock this out, you can still get N1 expression, and activate L2. And so some conclusions are that really it's the variation in N1 expression that seems to be driving the partial penetrance in these of these SKN1 mutations. And there seems to be some threshold around, say, 200 to 300 transcripts that gives you this transcripts of N1. You need to get there in a certain amount of in the right time to start to get gut expression. I think it would be really nice to have cell-specific data so I could say, look, you need X number, you need 50 transcripts in this in a cell in order to do that. I don't have that data yet. This functional context and these thresholds are really crucial to interpreting gene expression variations. So in my previous work, I looked at gene expression between species, but it was somewhat static, and there were differences, but it wasn't entirely clear what the significance of this variation was. Because just as there are differences, if you're differences above a threshold, then who cares? It might not matter so much. So I think, as we have better tools and as we can look at developmental context and try to tease out these thresholds, then we'll have a much better sense of what variation means and where variation is neutral and where these boundaries, functional boundaries, selection can actually see the variation, where those things are. And so I'd just like to thank Arjun Raj, who's a postdoc who invented the technique, and I've been collaborating with him. I'm in Alexander Byrne's lab. Eric Anderson, who was a grad student of Bob Horvitz, helped us get up to speed on C. elegans. And thank the NIH for funding. Thank you.
On your slide where you had the gene expression noise, it was noise for multiple embryos. At least
this one, yeah.
So you just took an average over many embryos.
Yeah, so what I'm doing is, each of these dots is a particular embryo.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm just fitting sort of the average curve, the average expression level. Yeah, yeah.
I guess it's really hard because you don't have resolution in this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But can you get an estimate to see whether there's similar
different noise
levels within,
within
embryos? Or
so I think I think the only way that right now I can really go about doing that would be I guess there's two ways I could try to do that. One would be to, I have nucleus position, right? So I can sort of fit a shell around it. Now, it's not going to be perfect because nuclei can be in any part of the cell. But if I fit a shell around and assign transcripts to particular cells, it's going to be an estimate. Then I can ask, are there differences where it really clustered in one cell versus another? Especially at these earlier stages, I think that would be really useful. Or I think that might be informative. Another way to do a similar sort of thing would just be to look at the density of transcripts across it, not really cell based, but let's say in a wild type you have this pattern, it's pretty much even density across, or you have some pattern of fluctuations across, at this level, and then see that it's very different for the mutants. So I think that would be the only way I could go about doing that right now. Yeah, I think it's worthwhile doing.
So skin one is maternal, so do you see difference between groups? So you take two individuals and look at the embryo cells.
And see difference in skin one transcript levels.
Or even the E2 expressions would basically whether it correlates to EHPR.
Okay, when we look at skin one expression in wild type animals, we have the data. I don't know the answer though. Actually, we haven't completed analyzing the data for the mutants for skin one expression, so I can't answer that question. For the, I can't answer your question. although I will say that technically, for technical reasons, for a single mother. I can't get enough embryos to ask sort of mother-to-mother variation. The only thing I could ask would be, I could ask at different days or different collections how much variation is there and whether there's a difference between mutants and normal. But yeah, we have the data, but it's not analyzed yet, so I can't answer it. Sorry. Yeah.
The big advantage of the in situ carbonization is that you gain spatial information.
Yeah. So we're not using spatial information.
We're
not using spatial information at all in this so far.
So I guess what I was wondering is if you have taken advantage of this different detection technology to compare to something like real-time PCR and quantitative PCR, which you could use more regularly when you're not getting spatial information, how do the two techniques compare?
Yeah. So in this system, we haven't done that, but in another system we have, and basically you get this for RT-PCR, for instance. You get the same sort of patterns so this guy Arjun Raj did this, and all I can say right now is somewhat qualitative, but where you see it when you induce something and you get around the same order of magnitude of increase in this technique and the RT-PCR, I can't comment on exactly what the numbers are. If twofold here corresponds to twofold there. Although I think it's pretty good. If I remember correctly, it's pretty good. Yeah, I can't tell. Yeah. Sorry. I just don't know.
There's different theories about how developmental robustness is achieved. And one of the extreme views, is that it's sort of a secondary or incidental consequence of the network structure of developmental pathways. And it really doesn't matter too much about the specific architecture of the links, just the fact that you have these multiple, potentially anastomose links gives a more robust output. Or some variable input. I almost get the sense here, that you're arguing that this particular node in the network might be more variable, or more variation in particular nodes, maybe much more important to the ultimate output. I'm just wondering if I'm interpreting this correctly, or where you stand on this.
So I think continuum. There's a couple points in there. One is, first of all, there's not many genes in this network, so it's not clear to me that the output of this whole complex network really necessarily applies here. Of course, there may be genes left to discover that feed in here, and there's some thoughts about some others, but the evidence for it is pretty weak. So there may be other genes here. It may be more complex than this, and definitely. One way that people have said you can get robustnesses by gene duplications. And certainly in this case, we have a very recent duplication here. These are also paralogs. They're a more ancient duplication. One interesting thing is that in C. briggsi, which is a close relative, you actually have 2N3 genes. So there's been a duplication in that lineage. You have 7 med genes, of which I think it's thought that some 5 are functional. So there's a lot of duplications. And so that's actually a very nice system to ask the question of So when I started the talk, I said, let's see that you duplicate the spinal surface P a gene and see if you get these aristi antennae. And if you duplicate it, you don't. Well, so similarly in Briggsy, maybe the threshold, the dynamics of this partial penetrance are very different because you have these two genes here. And so there's even more redundancy in the system. Maybe the relationship between, if you have two genes there, maybe N1 becomes less important or something like that. It can basically degrade away. So I think for this is a small network. I think the actual identity of genes may be somewhat important. The other thing is that I think for developmental systems, you know, it might be true that if you throw down nodes, you know, then you know it's somewhat resistant to pulling, but it might also be somewhat resistant to doing anything. So, you know, if you have there seem to be in these developmental networks master regulatory genes and sort of key genes that are expressed at particular points in time. So it's hard for me to, I think the architecture is relevant. And although maybe that doesn't quite answer the question of if you have some architecture to get development at particular, you know, to get things expressed at particular times, then robustness sort of comes along.
Mark Siegel does some nice work that relates to that question. Mark Siegel,
yeah.
He
was here.
Yeah, sort of, okay, you've already heard about it, then kind of knocking on individual genes and looking at how they affect noise. Right. So I think that type of approach is really needed to map you back on a network and understanding where the strongest canalizing points are.
Right.
So yeah, his view maybe has diverged a little bit from Bergman's. There was this recon meeting in Boston for the next 1 year or something, and Bergman has a recorded talk. I'm interested in this. It's a little worth listening to his talk. It's pretty entertaining. But yeah, because my bias tends to be along the same lines in the sense that, I mean, every one of these genes gets turned on at a certain time of development, a certain intensity. And you're not talking about the cis-regulatory architecture for each of these genes, but presumably it's evolved to carry out those functions, to turn on when it's supposed to achieve the threshold it needs, et cetera, et cetera. And so some of these properties, you know, I would think are evolved into the architecture of the cis-trans relationship of individual nodes in the network.
Yeah, I mean,
it seems like this is, you know,
Maybe the idea that you do have, you know, different parts of the network have different noise properties and different susceptibility to variation. And also, if it's the case that different, you know, species have different, well, we know it's the case for vulval development in the relative C. elegans, that there's different robustness in different species. And different decisions about how they make the decision about which cells are going to be formed, what part of the gulp, and how resistant they are to ablating cells. So we know there's variation there. And I think we would be hard-pressed to argue that the sort of any large-scale statistical features of the networks controlling that are really any different between elegans and Briggsy. Maybe. But so for the sort of gross scale, that, you know, you're going to have similar robustness because it's, you know, if there's, you know, 15,000 connections and 500 genes, or whatever, you know, that might be. I think that's going to be too coarse a scale to look at. You're not going to be able to really explain why there exists variation in robustness. On the other hand, I'm not. I want to remain agnostic of how much selection you can actually have for robustness, or in fact, how much selection you can have for gene expression noise, because it's not entirely clear to me that selection can be that strong. It may be strong within bounds. You know, you're not going to want to have normal wild-type expression like this, but it's not clear to me that, you know, for wild-type expression, that, you know, you can select to have it this noisy versus that noisy. It's not clear to me selection can really see those differences. No one knows how much selection can actually see the difference there. But certainly this versus that, we see what the consequences are. Thanks.